Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, Broadway musicals. My guest this week is Brett Shuford, one half of the couple that calls themselves the Broadway Husbands. Brett met his husband Stephen while they were both working on Broadway, and they started a blog about their lives together before embarking on their latest adventure, raising a kid. I'll be talking to Brett this week about his childhood in Texas, his viral video career, and a problem that he steadfastly ignored until it threatened to destroy everything. And then next week, I'll have his husband Stephen on to share his story. First, a quick reminder that I've got a weekly-ish newsletter that you can subscribe to at mattbaume.com. I'll be sharing details there about my upcoming book about the history of gay characters on sitcoms. And I've also got a YouTube channel where I post videos about film and TV history. I've got one coming up about Seinfeld's Not That There's Anything Wrong With That episode. That's at youtube.com/mattbaume. Also, big thanks to everybody who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Patrons get hours of exclusive videos about super queer pop culture history, stickers and stuff in the mail, and shoutouts in the credits of YouTube videos. Now, here's Brett. This week I'm talking to Brett, half of Broadway Husbands and Papa to Maverick. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
The very first live performance of a children's performance troupe when I was 6 years old called the Gingerbread Company. They sang songs about like, don't talk to strangers and don't do drugs. And it was in front of the public library in my small town, Beaumont, Texas.
Mm-hmm. So maybe not the most thrilling show, like not the most
well, when you're 6 years old and you're it was like the first time I'd ever seen anybody sing and dance live and in person. I'd only seen it in film, right? So I was just mesmerized. I was like, that's what I want to do.
What were you seeing that you're like, that's for me?
I just think I'd seen so many movie musicals, right? I loved the movie Annie. I loved Singing in the Rain. I loved The Wizard of Oz. But I didn't know you could actually do that live and in human flesh. So I think seeing people do that, I was like, oh, wait a sec. Mm-hmm. I can actually do that in life, like in nature. It's not just like on TV. And I was like, and I remember I just had such a visceral emotional reaction to it that I was like, that's what I want to do.
What was life generally like in, was it Beaumont was the name of the town?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So what was, you know, the environment there like?
Let's say, how do you explain it? So most people refer to the word Beaumont, the town Beaumont, to the movie Footloose, because it takes place in a town called Beaumont. It's not spelled the same, but it's, I would say it's very similar in its vibe. It's small, like way off suburbia, like it's 2 hours east of Houston. And so you're kind of out in the middle of nowhere in Southeast Texas. So it's this very culturally, not a very cultured place, right? So everyone sort of believes what everyone else believes and they only talk and hang out with the same people. So it's a very small town in that way. So I remember automatically at that age just feeling like I didn't really fit in because I knew what I wanted to do, and it was not something you could do in Beaumont, Texas. You had to live in a major city where there was they actually pay people to be performers. So I remember it was a very frustrating experience for me to live there. There's a lot of the conservative religious stuff that's involved in living in a small town like that too, and I was very effeminate and wanted to be, you know, on Broadway, like I said, and was struggling with my sexuality when I hit puberty, and I didn't have anywhere to go with that, right? So I could not wait to get out. I was just like, I just dreamed of the day I could leave Southeast Texas and live in New York City.
Yeah. Did you have any performance opportunities there?
There was community theater, right? Lots of community theater, lots of drama club and choir. And so, yeah, I did get to perform, and I was very lucky in that my parents let me, right? So my parents were very supportive of allowing me to take dance classes, but it came with a price. It came with a lot of teasing and a lot of not really fitting in. And so, you know, that was the hard part of living in a town like that is I think, especially in the 80s, like people just, you know, there's a lot of that toxic masculinity that you're being sort of thrown around and taught, of heteronormative, like men are, you're supposed to play football and baseball, which is what all my brothers did. I had three brothers, and I was doing not that. So it was a very interesting childhood looking back on it, when I was so stubborn that I didn't try, I did not allow myself to buy into anything that they were trying to sort of force me to believe needed to be true.
That must have been tough.
It was. I think it taught me a lot about fear and not letting myself, and just pushing through fear and being myself regardless of what other people think. And that's why I love helping people do the same thing. I have a business as a coach, a life coach, and a business coach for people. So I love helping people do that now, because I think I learned that very early on in my life.
Yeah. Were there times where you were tempted that you were like, oh, I'll just do football. If everybody's trying to make me do football, maybe the problem is me.
No, I hated sports. I mean, they tried, right? Like when I did T-ball, I did soccer, I did basketball, and I hated it all. Like I just didn't, and I was five, I was six, and I would yell, you know, I'd cry. I'd be on the outfield and my mom would be like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't have to do this to be a song and piano man.
Did you really? Was that really like such an intense focus for you even at that age?
Oh yeah. I knew what I wanted to do. And I was so passionate about it. I mean, I'm still like that. I'm very stubborn. Like once my mind is made, it's like, this is what I want to do and we're going to do it. Mm-hmm.
So you said that you knew that you had to get out of there and get to a big city. So how did you make that happen?
Very, again, persistence. I went to college. I listened to my parents and because they were very much of the mindset that I shouldn't go too far away from them to go to college. So I went to the University of Oklahoma for 2 years. And in between my college years, I would spend my summers working professionally at professional theater. So my first professional theater gig was when I turned 18. I had just officially come out of the closet. I'd never lived outside of Southeast Texas, and I was doing theater with all these Broadway people from New York City. I was so green. And I always, when I run into people from that, I usually apologize. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I was 17 and just overwhelmed. I didn't know what to do. So when I met all these people from New York and I started working with them, and then I went to Oklahoma and I was like, what am I doing in Oklahoma? I want to be in New York. I know people there now. So I ended up transferring because my parents basically said if I didn't get a degree, they were going to cut me off. So I had to finish my college degree. Mm-hmm. So I transferred to school in New York City to a private school called Wagner College, where I made the best friends for life, just the most amazing friends. And those 2 years were integral in my growth and development as an adult. And I continued to work professionally, but those 2 years of being in school in New York City, mind you, it was on Staten Island, which is probably good for me, because I think if it had been like NYU or some school in Manhattan, I probably never would have finished. Being, you know, a little bit further out of the city helped me stay focused. But that's how I ended up in New York. I was like, I was hating Oklahoma. If you think Texas is bad politically, Oklahoma is like a step down for liberal movement, for gay rights. And there was so much toxicity in the community at that school at that time around being gay. And I had already come out. I was very open about my sexuality, and there was just, you know, so many people were just heartbroken because of the religious oppression that they received growing up. And I was like, I don't need to be around this anymore. I'm done. So I moved to New York, and I actually ended up, this is actually a good story, because I like to tell students the story, because I was looking at Wagner College to transfer, but Wagner wasn't going to take all of my credits from University of Oklahoma. They wanted me to stay like another semester, which is smart business, but not affordable for me. So sure. I ended up, this is what I did. I ended up going through the entire catalog of classes at Wagner College and the entire catalog of classes at University of Oklahoma. And I highlighted all of the classes I had taken to that point that were equal in credits and in lessons. And I faxed them over to the administrative admissions office. And then I called them and I said, hi, is this the admissions office at Wagner College? I just sent you a fax and I'd like to go through each of these classes and tell you why you should transfer these credits. That's how bad I wanted to go. And they accepted every single credit that I called them about. And I was able to finish in 2 years.
Wow. Well, that must have been a really different culture.
Yeah.
What sticks in your mind, like when you were at Wagner, like what were the memorable moments, and were there times where you're like, okay, this was the right decision, or maybe did I make the right decision?
I mean, culturally, the biggest shock was just coming from the Midwest to Staten Island, right? Everyone in Staten Island or at Wagner generally was from New Jersey or from Brooklyn, right? It was a very Italian, very New York kind of, they're very direct. They speak their minds. They don't beat around the bush. You don't have time. When you live in New York City, you don't have time to be too overly friendly, right? Where when you come anywhere in Texas, like if you just, I just want to get a Starbucks cup, right? And the person behind the counter is like, how are you doing today? Tell me everything. You're just like, no, I just want to get my coffee, right? Mm-hmm. So that was a big culture shock for me moving to New York and going to Staten Island. Everyone was like, what? Why are you so happy? You're always smiling. And I'm like, I'm just being polite, right? So I think that was one of the original shocks to the system. And then there was also a lot of partying and drugs and alcohol, and I really just embraced that because I'd never really got to do that. So there were people that I got to, you know very well through that bonding experience of partying together. But then there were people, the other side of that was that being in New York City, I was able to work and network and meet people in the theater industry that I wouldn't have been able to meet if I had stayed in Oklahoma or Texas. And I think that helped make the transition into New York City and the theater industry a lot easier because I had access to, you know, it was close enough to the city to be able to do that. So those were the things that to me really stand out, is being able to really network at a high level while still in school. Where I think a lot, what I notice a lot of people who I went to school with in Oklahoma or even grew up with in Texas, if they did move to New York after finishing, they didn't last very long. You know, the culture shock and just the cost of living and not knowing anybody made it really hard. And I think that was one of the big bonuses of that.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a lot of there was a big upside career wise to having those connections, but also that it was really perilous for you just in terms of your health.
Yeah. I mean, and yeah, it was. And I think that also the drugs and alcohol that I discovered there also led me to getting sober, which I know Stephen talked to you about. But if I hadn't gone through that, I don't know. You know, if I ever would have discovered that, and then I met Stephen through recovery, and I've made some amazing other friends in that world as well. So, yeah.
What led to the decision to go sober?
You know, I remember. So I graduated in 2001 from college, and 3 months later, September 11th happened, and it was a huge traumatic experience for the world. But being in New York City, I lived alone in Hell's Kitchen. I just did not have the emotional equipment to be able to handle the trauma of that. And I just went into a deep spiral of using and abusing drugs. I'd already was doing that, but it definitely increased. And then I was auditioning. I was trying to get a Broadway show, and I couldn't understand why it hadn't happened yet. I think I was 24. And I was like, I should have been on Broadway 3 times by now, which is so silly looking back on it. But at the time, that's the kind of pressure I put on myself. And I remember I started seeing a therapist. And in therapy, I highly recommend therapy. We would talk about, you know, I would say things like, I keep blacking out. Like it happens once a week where I black out. And he's like, do you think that's normal? And I'm like, yeah, doesn't everybody black out once a week? And he's like, okay, do you think you have a drinking problem? And I'm like, no, I'm sure it's, you know, growing up in a conservative environment, and I'm sure 9/11. And he's like, okay, if you don't have a drinking problem, why don't you stop drinking? And I was like, okay. And I don't think I made it a week. I think it went like 6 days. And I was like, and it hit me. It just hit me then. I was like, oh, maybe I do have a problem. What if I just try this? Like, what if I just try 30 days of not drinking? Right. And I remember I just kept saying to him and to friends, I was like, I just feel like I can't meet my potential. I just feel like there's so much potential in me and I'm not meeting it. And I remember in that, like, within 3 months of deciding to get sober is when I booked my first Broadway show.
Wow.
And I was
that's a pretty clear sign.
I was like, okay, I think this is the right decision. And I just stuck to it.
What sort of, that must have involved making a lot of changes in your life. Like it sounds like it was a pretty important way for you to, deal with, understandably, a lot of stress and trauma from 9/11 and then also career frustration. So did you find something that kind of took the place, or was a more productive presence in your life?
Well, I think that if anyone's looking to get sober, I think that the recovery rooms are amazing. I went to meetings every day for at least the first 5 years. And so that was super powerful for me because it healed a lot of relationship stuff. You know, I started to meet people who weren't, our relationship wasn't centered around using or even sex. I think for a lot of gay men, there's a lot of objectification that happens in our community. And I think at that point, I thought anybody who wanted to be friends with me wanted one of two things. They either wanted to have sex with me, or they wanted to, network and have a career. Right. And it was in that recovery work that I was able to go, oh, these people actually just like me for me and want to be friends with me. And we can just be friends. And I think it healed a lot of internalized homophobia that was taught to me. Right. And I think anyone who goes through that conservative religious stuff, we're told just how much to hate ourselves. And I think that not using and avoiding the emotions helped me get really clear about how to love myself and unconditionally, and how to love other people unconditionally. And that was super powerful for me. And it also turned this idea of being on Broadway and having a career as an actor, it turned it away from me and more to how can I be of service to others. And that was a huge mindset shift for me, because I thought everything was about like, well, if I can't get a Broadway show, then I must suck. Right. As opposed to like, well, I'm probably just not right for this one.
Yeah. So tell me about the ways that things started turning around. You said like pretty abruptly or pretty quickly, you got cast in a show. So how did things start to change for you?
Yeah, I think it just started to change in that I was no longer living my life to have a career on Broadway. I was living my life and I happened to have a career on Broadway, and that paid the bills, and that, allowed me to support myself doing things, going places, traveling, dating, which was also like traumatic in New York City before I met Steven. I think that was a huge shift. I tell this all the time to young performers, or at least people who are like kind of graduating college. There's this transition that no one prepares you for, from when you're young and high school and college, and you're just performing all the time for free. Cause you're actually, or even in college, you're paying to be a performer. And then you get into the industry and you no longer get to decide. You don't get to pay. Like, it's like they need somebody who's 6'2", has this color hair, can sing this high of a note. And if that's not you, you're not going to perform in that show. So there's a huge shift that happens from understanding who you are as a person is not necessarily defined by what it is that you do. And I think that was the transition that happened for me when I made that decision. I started to take care of myself, put self-care first, put my mental health first, put, other people and commitments first. And I think that really it made it a much more gratifying experience to be pursuing a career as an actor.
What are some experiences from that time that maybe the shows or things that you did outside of the career that you're proud of that you might not have been able to do if you hadn't done that work?
That's a good question. Well, I wouldn't have met Steven, so I wouldn't would never have had that relationship. But I ended up directing some. I ended up choreographing actually at Wagner College.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up.
What were the shows?
I ended up choreographing Carousel at Wagner. I ended up starting to create a lot of content, like viral videos. I would get my friends together and we would put on musicals on the subway. And that was super fun. You can see those on my YouTube channel. And I think that stuff, I don't think I ever would have just gone like I had an idea and I'm like, I'm just going to do it. And those things were so fun. And they taught me so much about producing and directing and, you know, again, pushing through any sort of fear and doubt that I would have had.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like some of that is like jobs, like, you know, doing Carousel, and then other stuff is more passion projects.
Yeah.
What were you mentioned the musicals on the subway, which is maybe the most musical theater major thing I've ever heard of. But tell me about like how those went and how you put something like that together.
Well, I had this idea where I was thinking about those guys on the subway who go, "What time is it? Showtime!" And they put on like a boombox and they start doing break dancing and they're hanging off the rails and stuff. And I was thinking, gosh, what if somebody was like, "What time is it? Places!" And they did a musical on the subway. And so my first show, of course, I was thinking of the very first, you know, what's considered the first musical, Oklahoma. So I got a group together and we got into like a studio and we did little cuts, clips of us doing the show. And I had a friend get costumes and we literally all dressed up like characters from the musical Oklahoma, got on the subway and performed the show and filmed it. And then I edited that into a video. And then that was so much fun that I was like, let's do Rent. So then we did Rent. And then I had this big idea. I was plotting this whole thing to do The Music Man on the subway and the pandemic hit. I was trying to figure out how to get a marching band into Grand Central Station. Cause I thought that would be the best finale. Like we all come up out of the subway and we're in Grand Central and there's a marching band, but it was got a little too complicated.
That sounds elaborate. starting with Oklahoma, I mean, was there anything to that choice of show as sort of, you know, a really idealized and musical version of the state that you had left to come to New York?
No, I don't think it was related in any way. I just thought those characters on the subway would be hilarious. And then seeing people's reactions to us, you know, doing sweet, you know, Story with a Fringe on top on the subway, I thought that would just be hilarious.
There's a really great tension there between the extremely rural nature of Oklahoma and the very modern urban milieu of the subway.
Totally. Totally.
But that, you know, and it sounds like you weren't doing that for, you know, what's the career opportunity? Are we going to get discovered by doing this or anything like that?
Well, it's funny too. I think I was really obsessed with creating YouTube videos. I had made this commitment. I'm going to make a YouTube video for a year. Every single week. So in brainstorming that, I came up with all these ideas and then I was like, I'm just going to do it. Cause again, like when I have an idea, I just like go with it and just commit. So it was part of that. Like, how do I grow a YouTube channel? I wanted to learn more about it. And what's interesting is like, it really helped teach me a lot about social media and the algorithms and how all of that stuff works. And that's now what I do. I coach people on how to build their following online. And I don't think if I had done all of that exploration, I had no real purpose. I think I thought maybe I would be discovered like Todrick Hall, like with his content, but I'm not that, you know, I don't think I had the, I just didn't have the, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And I wasn't going to I wanted people to feel valued. I didn't want to just like keep asking people to do this stuff for free. These people should get paid. I didn't have the budget and I just didn't have the guts or the I don't know what the word is, to just be like, keep asking people to do this stuff for free. It just wasn't, it didn't seem right.
Well, so what was the response that these kinds of things got? And what did you feel like when you started to see the audience
building? More importantly, the people who did it had such a good time. That mattered the most to me because everyone involved was like, this is cool. And it's something that they were all like super proud of. Because it takes a lot of guts to do a musical on the subway. And,
sure,
you know, you're it's basically a social experiment. You don't know what people are going to do. So that was number one. And then number two, like, the reaction was always disappointing. I think I always thought these videos would go viral, you know, but there's not enough people, I think, that love musicals on YouTube. So I don't know. I was like, but this video is so good. Why isn't everyone watching this? But the people who do watch it leave wonderful comments and say how much they really appreciated it. And every time Rent, like when Rent Live performed, that video kind of went viral again. Or so, you know, it's fun. I loved creating that stuff. I would love to continue to be that's why I continue to create content like I do. But that was a different level of creating content. It required a lot of prep and production. And again, it's just hard if you don't have the budget. I want to pay people for their craft and their time. And so, you know, if anybody's an investor and wants to invest in creating content, hit me up.
Yeah, well, got a lot of tell me about the switch, or maybe it isn't exactly a switch, but it sounds like there's sort of a transition from live theater and in-person performance to more online stuff, and also being a advisor for other people who are looking to, you know, create stuff to put in front of an online audience.
Yeah. I mean, it was sort of a natural development. Like I said, I was doing Paramore, which is a Cirque du Soleil show on Broadway. And I had my own dressing room and I was making a good check and the show was doing well. So I was like, okay, what can I do on the side? And so that's when the YouTube videos started. And then from that, people were kind of coming to me all the time, especially theater people who have zero marketing skills and no one teaches anyone in a BFA program how to run a business. So people were coming to me like, how did you create this content? What do you do? Like, you know, and that's where the coaching started. And then we started Broadway Husbands in 2018, and that has grown so significantly that then people were then coming wanting help on how to build their social media platforms. And when the industry shut down in 2020, that everyone was like, oh my gosh, I have no theater work. There's no auditions. I don't know what to do. Where do I put this creativity that is in me, this ability to be a performer? Oh, I should figure out social media. I'll hire Brett. So it sort of evolved as things just sort of happened. And I have found in the last 3 years that I have just as much satisfaction, if not more satisfaction, from having an Instagram Reels go viral as I did taking a bow on a Broadway stage. And it requires less effort and less hours. And it's and I can do it from the comfort of my home. So it's been an interesting journey. Who knows if that'll last? I mean, I definitely am a creature of curiosity, and I will definitely hit some point where I'm like, maybe I could do this. But right now that's been a super fun thing. And then I love coaching. I love it so much that it's pretty much become my full-time job. I used to coach on the side of being an actor, and now I'm an actor on the side of being a coach.
What is the, you know, and I'm not asking you to like give away your secrets, but is there stuff that you advise folks who are excited about making things and being creative, like things that you tell them just to prepare them for what that life is like?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the thing I really try to help people understand because most people get a little bit self-conscious, and let's face it, we've all seen a lot of people do social media badly in our time. And so we are so afraid to be those people. And the truth is, if you're afraid of being that person, you're not that person, because typically those people aren't even aware that they're doing that. So, but I try to I try to help people understand that creating content is an act of service. That it doesn't always have to be like this pressure that, you know, most people are comparing their beginning to someone else's middle. They see somebody who's already viral and they're like, oh God, how do I ever make that kind of viral content? And that's not fair, right? We compare and despair. So I usually try to help people figure out, okay, who do I want to create content for? Who's that ideal audience? And what kind of content do I want to entertain? Do I want to inspire or do I want to educate? Because we're all able to do those things. Like being an expert doesn't mean you have to have a master's degree in something. Being an expert means you're just one step ahead of somebody else. And there's somebody out there that you could serve and help. And so I try to help people unlock whatever blocks they have so that they can just start showing up consistently for that person that they can help.
Can you talk about, like, you may not want to divulge this kind of stuff, but some of the clients that you've worked with, like, what have you helped them do?
Yeah. So I help them kind of recognize their own personal brand, maybe even simplify their systems. So what a lot of people do is they gather a lot of information from different places. Like, oh, I took this course or I watched this Instagram live and this person said to do that. So I'm doing that. And like, so I help them kind of go, okay, but does that really resonate with you? And does that serve you? And like, if you're a parent and you have very limited time, are you really going to want to spend 3 hours making a piece of content, right? You probably don't have time to do that. So let's simplify. And then the other thing I always tell people is that creating social media or building a brand online requires consistency, which means you have to create a habit. And posting content every day or frequently and whatever works for you needs to be as habitual as brushing your teeth. And it can be. So I help people build habits around showing up online.
Is there stuff that clients or people that you've helped have made that was successful, that went viral, that you look at and you're like, that was a success. And I'm proud of that person.
Yeah, yeah. I have this one client who I love. His name's Alex Miller. And he has a YouTube channel. And he's really into amusement park rides. And within a month of us working together, he made his first $2,000 in YouTube ads and gained all of these followers. And I was like so proud of him because he just went for it. So he's one that I absolutely love. But even like, you know, I've worked with Tony winners and entrepreneurs and producers and casting directors. And always what I think about with them is anybody who's able to enjoy showing up for their audience, regardless of the results that it produces, then it's a win. If it feels painful, if it feels uncomfortable, then you're probably doing it wrong. And we can help you like get to a place where it just feels like an extension of who you already are.
Now you've recently taken on a very different position of responsibility over another human being. Tell me about becoming a dad.
Oh my gosh. Well, we wanted this for so long. It took us 4 years. And Maverick is so cute, so sweet. I mean, he's only 3.5 months old, so it's sort of a simpler time right now. But it's something that we always talked about. I always wanted. And I remember, you know, like I said, I have three brothers, and two of them just so easily were able to have kids. And I remember thinking, gosh, if I could, I would love to be able to have a kid too. It's just so easy for them. How do I make this happen? Because I think if I could do that, I think I'd be a great dad. I remember thinking that so vividly when I met my nieces. So the fact that it's happened now, it just feels natural because it was something we envisioned for so long.
How has it changed your life?
Well, check back with me in about 18 years. I'll let you know. But right now, it's just mostly about really keeping it in the day. I definitely feel, you know, there's something about, and I think this is just could be me, I don't know, but I could tolerate a good amount of intolerance in the world as myself. I grew up in a very small town, small-minded bubble of people, of everyone who believed the same thing. And if you were different, you were weird and judged and made fun of. And I could handle a good amount of that. And God knows we're all facing it. When you look at the news and you see what Supreme Court's doing to women and what they're threatening to do to gay marriage. But now that I'm a dad, I just don't have the tolerance for it anymore. I don't want to surround my family with people who don't see us as equals in the eyes of God or the eyes of the law. And when you look at what's happening, especially like right now, we're living back in Texas. I don't necessarily feel like I have the strength or the tolerance that I would have if I wasn't wanting to raise my child in a place that is fully accepting and tolerant and loving. And so I don't know, I don't know what that means, but that's been the biggest change for me. I've noticed is my level of willingness to stick out the discomfort for change is gone down immensely. I'm like, there's other people who are built for change, fighting for equality in places where it doesn't exist. I just want to go live somewhere where we already feel it and we feel safe and we feel equal, so that my son can grow up somewhere where he doesn't feel or have, we can tell him there's people who don't think that his family is equal, but he doesn't have to live in that environment.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like you've really taken the stubbornness, which I mean in a good way, that you had when you were a kid. Like, I should be on stage. I should be a performer.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, become a radical principle for you, expecting equality, which I think is reasonable everywhere in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just, for my son, I just want him to be surrounded by people who love and accept his family exactly as they are. And we don't have to defend ourselves or explain ourselves, And that's, I think that's a hard thing, to find is only certain spots in America. And, where I think that exists, unfortunately. I thought we could be more representative of that. That's why we started our social media account, but it's proving to be harder as a father to want to subject ourselves to being in an environment like that.
Yeah. Well, sure. I can, it's one thing to be an activist, but something that I've heard from a lot of people who were activists as a family, there's a couple or, something larger, that it's kind of exhausting to have that, to be public about your private life and to, there's a lot of good that you can do, but also it's important, from what I've heard from people who are in a similar line of work, to have some level of remove and some distance where you're like, okay, and this is just us. This is just family. This isn't going on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's also a real need to protect our mental health, right? So we get enough nasty comments in our posts. There's plenty of haters and trolls out there online. That to then go to the grocery store and feel like we're getting death stares from people. It's just, It's just like, I don't want to get it from all sides. Yeah.
So tell me about how you create that. And what are the ways that you've kind of shaped your life and the way that feels fulfilling and you feel happy and surrounded by the right people?
Well, I think just remembering the people that, there's people I went to college with that I think accept and love us to such an amazing degree. There are these friends of ours here in Texas who, when I'm with them, it's just easy. I don't have to explain anything and they don't say things that feel disrespectful or rude. So I think it's just about really opening ourselves up and feeling to those safe spaces. And then I think also using our social media platform to help educate people, right? That's really the goal here is okay, here's a same-sex parent couple who've made their living in the arts. It's 100% possible. You don't have to be, you can be sober and you can be successful and you can find love and you can raise a family. And hopefully what I'm hoping our platform does is we can help other gay couples feel safer in the world wherever they are and know that they belong.
Well, so if folks want to check you out and find you online, where should they go?
Yeah, check out Broadway Husbands at Broadway Husbands. And you can check me out at Brett Shuford. If anyone's interested in learning about, more about my coaching, go to my website. There's all sorts of cool resources, free resources there. So you can just go to brettshuford.com. Everything's there.
Perfect. Well, Brett, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Brett for joining me, and thanks to you for listening, and thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and patron-only bonus videos. Check out my YouTube channel for deep dives into gay TV. That's at youtube.com/MattBaum. And subscribe to my weekly newsletter for fun stories about queer pop culture at mattbaum.com. The theme song for the Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin McLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.